If you're feeling exhausted, puffy, anxious, foggy, gaining weight, or just not like yourself, you're not imagining it. Women in their 30s, 40s, and 50s are experiencing massive hormonal shifts, and no one is explaining what's actually happening. I'm Katie Whalen, co-founder of Joy. I built Joy because I lived this. The fatigue, the mood swings, the weight changes, the confusion. Your symptoms are biological, not personal. And AI-generated lab reports won't fix them. Every Joy lab includes a visit with a licensed clinician who specializes in women's hormones and connects every biomarker to how you feel. Energy, metabolism, mood, sleep, skin, weight, everything. Then, we personalize real solutions. Hormone therapy, peptide therapy, supplements, and lifestyle protocols. Get started at joyandblogues.com today. This month, new customers get 50% off labs, and you can add our estrogen face cream for just $1 with clinician approval. Use promo code podcast at joyandblokes.com.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to get stronger just around the corner, so you can give everything you've got. Whether you want to crush a few reps before class with our expanded strength equipment or sweat it out on your way home from work, with over 2,800 locations, there's a Planet Fitness close to you, and most are open 24 hours. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends January 30th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome to Dialogues with Creators. I am the host, Barbara Tucker. The purpose of this podcast is to explore creativity and creative people in various walks of life and work, especially in the Northwest Georgia and Southeast Tennessee region. We do not limit our discussions to a certain form of creativity. Today, our creative person is a scholar and professor who has recently written a book on a creative response to a seemingly intractable economic, political, and social problem. Join us for a conversation with Dr. Rick Herder. Rick, I'd like to start with how I met you. In 2006, I took two doctoral classes at Georgia State University. And that was a struggle for me in my life, but that's another story. You were in a rhetoric and public communication course with Dr. James Darcy that I took. It was a fascinating class. And you sat close to me at this square table, sort of configuration we had in a seminar class. And during the class, I thought, is there anything that this tall gentleman has not read, especially in this field of rhetorical theory and publication? So, how did you get to that class at Georgia State University in Atlanta on a Thursday night? Fall semester 2000.
All right. Well, Barbara, I guess I want to start off by saying that I appreciate your introduction. At the same time, there are many, many things that I have not read in the field of rhetoric and public communication. And as you know, it's sometimes humbling to try to keep up with all the developments. But to take it back to my origins, how I ended up there, I was born and raised in a small town in central Minnesota and ended up teaching school up there, coaching speech and debate, local high school. And then my wife and I owned a restaurant for a bit, and we got an itch to move south. So we moved down to southern Florida and raised our family in the Naples region.
Yeah, I just have to say,
yes,
that's like one extreme to the other.
Yes.
I can't imagine the difference culturally and definitely weather-wise.
Oh, it was radical. But what that's important to everything we're going to be talking about today, because the first place that I taught down there was a little town called Immokalee, Florida. And Immokalee, Florida is a place where there are thousands and thousands of migrant farmers that should arrive there every year during harvest season. The size of the community about doubles. And the students that I taught at Immokalee High School were predominantly farm worker families. So that had a big impact on my life and the research interests and such. And so I went back to college then at middle age. You know, I mean, some people have middle age crises and do other things. I just started listening carefully to the things that my debaters were learning. I was really interested in exploring these ideas more. And so I left a perfectly good job and I went off to graduate school. That's the short version of how I ended up there. I expected to be in graduate school studying policy debate, which is something that I coached. But I realized quickly that I didn't want to be coaching debate the rest of my life. And so I was shifting around for another research topic. And one of my daughters was supporting a boycott against Taco Bell that was sponsored by some farm workers out of Immokalee, Florida. And so I started checking up on what they were doing. Then they won this campaign against Taco Bell. And I found a research interest dissertation on corporate protest. So that's the short version of how.
Okay. So you and your wife moved to Atlanta area.
We moved to Atlanta from Florida. I spent 5 years, 5 years riding MARTA down to Georgia State. Okay. And worked on this.
So, and your master's degree was at?
My master's degree was through the university.
Okay, that's a really interesting story. We could talk a lot about debate because I used to be a debate coach myself, and right. Started with the policy in the NDT, they called it.
Oh my goodness, yes. And you're familiar with students talking.
And flowing and the, you know, all the issues that you have to do.
I wrote my master's.
Yeah, although I have to say, and then when I was coaching later, we did the values debate, the CETA. And I have to say that probably it trained my brain better than just about anything for logic and critical thinking. You know, even though I was doing it as the instructor, as the teacher, listening to those debates, you really, you know, your head can explode if you don't, if you're not.
Sure. It's really invigorating.
Mm-hmm.
And the ideas that my students were batting around in policy debate, and also in values debate, high school values.
Yeah.
So I have some other forms of debate, but spending time with my students, kicking those ideas around, drove me back to graduate
school. Okay. So you were at Georgia State 5 years.
It was.
And then you...
Then I went back home to Minnesota. There was a job. I saw this job showed up. It showed up online, and I looked at the description and thought, "Oh my goodness! You know, there can't be more than one person in the country who can fill that job." And it turns out, like, I was the only one who could fit what they were looking for. And so I went back home and had spent more than a decade teaching back in my home state.
Okay, and back.
I did.
So did you do debate up there?
I served as a judge sometimes for high school and college debates and speech tournaments. No, I taught debate at university.
Mm-hmm. So talk a little bit about your experience there. That it was a... not a large institution.
Southwest Minnesota State University, where I taught for 4 dozen years, is out in the prairies, far away from where I grew up. Out in the prairies, almost in South Dakota. And I had a wonderful time there. I tell students all the time that I love being around, you know, rural farm folks, because I grew up around people who love to talk about, you know, hunting, fishing, and cows, right? But I also love the diverse environments like we had at Georgia State, where we have students many, many different cultural backgrounds. And at Southwest, I had all of it. large national contingency. I worked quite a bit with students who were part and part of our diversity and inclusion program there. So I really, really felt honored to be able to work.
Did you have any connection with farm workers, or that not what was going on? How are you?
Not so much through Southwest State, or Southwest Minnesota State, rather. What I did do is I maintained my research agenda. Working on publishing some articles and doing some more research beyond my dissertation regarding the coalition.
Okay. And so now you're back in beautiful Northwest Georgia, kind of in the middle, not flat, like
right.
Those two places.
Yeah, I should say,
I mean,
my wife and I have a strong connection to this area because 25 years ago, our daughter, our oldest daughter, went to college, graduated, met her husband there, and all that. They settled into this community. So we've been coming in and out of the Chattanooga region for very long. Yeah. And so we're happy to be here. We have two daughters who live in the region.
Okay.
We feel like we come
back. Right. And, you know, I was talking to somebody the other day about it's hard to explain how Chattanooga is different than what it was then or when I moved here, which was mid-70s. It's a whole different kind of place. So, which is good.
Right.
Yeah. So, the worst interview question is, what is your book about? And you can talk about the genesis of your book. And even though that is a horrible question, I'm going to ask it anyway.
If you're feeling exhausted, puffy, anxious, foggy, gaining weight, or just not like yourself, you're not imagining it. Women in their 30s, 40s, and 50s are experiencing massive hormonal shifts, and no one is explaining what's actually happening. I'm Katie Whalen, co-founder of Joy. I built Joy because I lived this. The fatigue, the mood swings, the weight changes, the confusion. Your symptoms are biological, not personal. And AI-generated lab reports won't fix them. Every Joy lab includes a visit with a licensed clinician who specializes in women's hormones and connects every biomarker to how you feel. Energy, metabolism, mood, sleep, skin, weight, everything. Then, we personalize real solutions. Hormone therapy, peptide therapy, supplements, and lifestyle protocols. Get started at joyandblokes.com today. This month, new customers get 50% off labs, and you can add our estrogen face cream for just $1 with clinician approval. Use promo code podcast at joyandblokes.com.
And you can answer it better than I can. So what is your book about?
All right. Yeah. Well, we've already set this up a little bit by talking about Ockley, Florida. And the book is about a group of farm workers and a human rights organization called the Coalition of Immokalee Workers. We were founded early 1990s, Immokalee, actually just shortly after I left teaching at high school. And what I focus on, actually I have a co-author, is Dr. Grace Adler-Rozell. She's emeritus professor of management studies from New Mexico State. And Grace Ann and I and some others have done some ethnographic work with the Coalition of Activist Researchers. We actually marched with them to protest events. Also spent time interviewing several members in the coalition and some of the people who've worked with them. And the book is about how they have used storytelling in public campaigns and in other ways to challenge abusive labor practices. Immokalee, Florida, for several decades, certainly through the 50s, 60s, up through the 1980s, and was known as ground zero for modern slavery. And over a period of about 15 or so years, group of farm workers that we're talking about, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, was involved in working with local police and federal authorities to investigate and uncover and prosecute a number of slavery. And so now that I'm sitting here, the exact numbers escape. It's at least 9 different slave rings. And a former student of mine from the region, not of Mockley High School, but another high school in the region, was actually arrested, convicted, and spent time in jail for his role. And so what's happened, but the book focuses on how they accomplished this, how they challenged that those abusive practices in agriculture, Florida. What they did is they worked with tomato growers in the region and with some major corporations, including companies like McDonald's, Taco Bell, Walmart, Whole Foods, and others. We've all come together to form something called the Fair Food Program. It's a private initiative that has set standards for fair labor practices in the tomato industry in Florida. And if you go to Immokalee, Florida today, it has the best labor standards in the United States and probably the world, thanks to the Fair Food Program. This is something that was developed by the farm workers themselves through many, many hours, months, and years of discussions and negotiations with local growers and such, and protest campaigns. They've arrived at this. And the Fair Food Program, its operating philosophy, they call it worker-driven social responsibility, is being held up by labor researchers and others around the world as a new gold standard, they're calling it, for eradicating labor abuse supply chains. And so that's the focus of the book, is how this group of farm workers was able to craft a solution to really pernicious, persistent problem. U.S. agriculture, and they proposed a solution that could be expanded at global scale. So right now, as we speak, the U.S. Department of Labor gave them a $2.5 million grant, and they're in the process of expanding the Fair Food Program regions of Mexico, Chile, and South Africa. Separating the issue, they're expanding it into the fishing industry. And beyond that, they've expanded the Fair Food Program as it stands down in South Florida into 10 different states. It's farms all the way up the East Coast of the United States, part of the West, all around. So, and they're, I could keep going for a long time, but that's basically what we're talking about. We talk about how all along they've used story love to expose terrible things that have happened in dark places that hold people accountable. And that's our.
Okay, that leads me to a lot of questions. In terms of going back to the beginning of the slavery rings, were these situations where individuals were brought from another country to work and under false pretenses, maybe, and once they got here, they were without really any ability to move or go or change or
right. Regarding slavery. Yes, there are basically two routes through which people were ending up enslaved in the tomato industry. And something, and I want to clarify something before I go any further. That is, when we talk about slavery, there's one famous slavery researcher, Kevin Dales. He says, we're not talking about jobs that suck. Mm-hmm. We're talking about slavery as people were working. Anytime a human or someone is forced against their will to labor and to labor without compensation under threat of
wow.
And so, and beyond that, called slave-like conditions, where they are, it may not be that people may actually be receiving some pay, but the working conditions are abusive of the polite word to outsiders. It may even appear like slavery. But the two routes that we're talking about are, one, what you suggested, and that is, this would be where workers from, say, Honduras, Mala, southern Mexico, Oaxaca area in southern Mexico, seek to come into the United States because of fleeing things like poverty. So they will work with coyote human smugglers to come across the U.S. border. And the deal is that they can pay the coyotes off when they arrive in the United States. They're going to work in the fields and make money and pay out the smugglers. But of course, what happens is that it's a bait switch operation. Yeah, they have. And then the other route is to BP's a route in which workers, and this was a big operation that just cracked in southern Georgia, actually. Tresio Syndicate had a whole pipeline. I think there were about 80,000 workers in the pipe, many of them still in Mexico, having made it to the United States already, who were brought here with perfectly legal visas. But once they arrived, the syndicate took their visas away from them and then forced them to work. Certainly, it's slave-like conditions, sometimes actually slave conditions. And so there's a major federal conviction on forced labor charge.
So in one case, that they would be undocumented, but in the second case, they have their papers.
Right.
See, these are things that people, when you talk about immigration debates, they're overlooked. They're not discussed.
It gets very complicated.
Right. Because most people don't understand things like the visa situation you're talking about, that particular visa or.
Right. And as an example, I mean, what the investigations that the CIW did down into the slavery operations down in South Florida were groundbreaking. Sense that when the FBI came down to work with them, they didn't know what to do because they'd never been involved in slavery. Something like this. And so the CIW has won numerous awards for slavery. One of the things that came out of this, out of their investigations, is some T visa, which means that someone who has been trafficked to the United States and had placed it in an abusive working situation, in other words, slave, can be granted a T visa, which allows them to stay in the United States on the condition that they testify against their slavery in federal court. And that has been used a number of times.
So would you say that in these situations, the majority are from Central America?
Sure. Some of the farm workers do come from other places. There has been fewer citations or number of cultural reasons that migrated.
So when you say that they used storytelling.
Yes.
One of the other people I interviewed was a woman with a group called Narrative 4. Are you not familiar? Okay. You should look it up. It's Narrative 4, and it's an international program where people get together in a community and they sit and I would tell you my story, you know, and it might be about something along this line. And then you would have to tell me the story back in first person as a way of creating community and other things. You know, it's very interesting.
That is.
Thing. So, but in this case, by telling their story, you mean in, would they do it in through media or through community events or through, protest rallies or
all of them.
Okay.
All of them. I'll give you two quick examples. One, concerns a young man who was beaten by one of his field supervisors to me. This happened very early on, shortly after the Coalition of Immokalee Workers was founded in the 1990s. But this young man was middle school or high school age, was working out in the fields in the hot Florida sun. Should have been in school probably, but he was. And he asked the supervisor if he could take a break and get a drink. No, young man asked two more times, and supervisor finally just said, "Aren't you hearing? Aren't you listening to me?" And he beat him there. And so what happened is farm workers rallied, and they rallied around this young man, but then they went to the home of the field supervisor, holding the bloody shirt up in the air, and rallied hundreds of farm workers out there saying this has to be dealt.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a really important point history of the CIW. But then they held on to that shirt, and just a few years later, the Washington Post ran a story about the Coalition of Immokalee Workers in that incident, and there's photograph of them. CIW is one of Lucas is holding, just standing there with this sort of very serious look on his face, just holding the shirt, this bloody shirt out. Right? Well, that's a story.
Mm-hmm.
And that's public storytelling. So that sort of public storytelling, there's a lot that we could say, those of us who had some training in rhetoric, about what's going on there. It's Aristotle's idea. Right there. And you don't have to say a lot about that, because what they did is they went to their first corporate target was Taco Bell. They went to Taco Bell and said, "This happened in tomato fields. Were you first? Do you want tomatoes that were harvested under these conditions in your tacos?" Ultimately, one of the vice presidents from Taco Bell came out to Immokalee and said, "Show me what's they touched." So that's an example of storytelling. Beyond that, though, under what's known as the Fair Food Program, they do really in-depth social audits with farm workers. Because one of the problems that we have in these global supply chains is that we send in auditing teams. They look around, talk to a few workers, and they say, "Are there any problems? Working environment safe? Is there any sexual harassment? Have you heard of anybody being forced to work against their will, et cetera?" The long checklist of things. They look around, check it off. And then what we're finding is that in many, many incidents, they're simply not uncovering the abuses. Well, in the Fair Food Program, they go in and they make sure that whoever's interviewing speaks the language, knows the culture of the workers. Even the workers are paid for their time when they're talking to somebody. They have an extensive education program to build trust. And then they interview at least 50% of the workers. Then the smaller farms, 100%. Right. And so they do a lot of, they lay a lot of groundwork to ensure there's trust. And then when they go in to talk to workers, workers are going to tell their story. That's the, and then so that's where storytelling is at the heart of improving labor conditions in global supply chain.
It's in
establishing that level of trust so that stories.
Yeah, under the first conditions, they would probably be living too much under fear.
Two quick examples. There was a textile building that collapsed in Bangladesh famously a number of years ago, the Rana Plaza collapse. That building had been certified by audit. Recently down in tomato fields in Mexico, there was a large tomato operation that had been certified as having fair labor standards by two independent auditations. And they supplied tomatoes to many, many retailers and grocers in the United States, still do. And yet, when there was evidence that came out, very clear, compelling evidence, rampant slavery and abuse. Why? Two different auditing organizations just didn't catch it. But the Fair Food Program is designed to be sort of a better mousetrap in that regard and get the stories.
Mm-hmm. So at the beginning, was it totally the people who were enslaved, or was there an sort of an outside helper situation that somebody recognized it was something amiss here, something had?
Again, it's both.
Okay.
It's both in. It's really clear there was a cohort of workers who were very.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, there was a man who's now an attorney, and his wife was now an attorney. I believe they were legal aides at the time. But their names are Greg Asbed and Laura Cherino. And Greg Asbed and Laura Cherino were working for nonprofit legal organizations in Florida. And so they started having conversations with farm workers, realized that there was concern about labor conditions in the region. And so they started working with those farm workers. From the beginning, they have done all that they can. When interviewed, people ask Greg and Laura, you know, was this you coming along and teaching the farm workers how to do this? They will tell you emphatically, don't make this about us.
Mm-hmm.
These are ideas that came from the farm workers. So I think where Greg and Laura have been really, really important is that Greg had legal expertise, obviously, and helped the coalition chief fundraising.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really good drawing in, for example, pro bono legal talent mm-hmm. to help them acquire grants, to help negotiate certain difficult knots, Congress, state legislature, mm-hmm. such along the way as they went. At the same time, the ideas that there were for the Fair Food Program really do appear to have bubbled out from the workers themselves.
Mm.
So it's again a complicated process. Laura Cherino, his wife, Greg's wife, Laura sat down with the workers and said, how do we want to handle this? And the workers themselves, people like Luke Stanitas, who I mentioned before, and a number of others actually risked their own lives to go in and do the investigation. Mm.
Wow. Okay. This is a more serious topic than sometimes I get to it on this podcast, but it's fascinating.
Can I add something?
Sure. Absolutely.
You know, when we spent time with the Coalition of Mocking Workers, though, what we always come away with is how much they want.
Mm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, yes, these are very serious things. But at the same time, you know, when you spend time with them, these are people who really get find a lot of joy in.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's important.
So you have a book that's going to be published by Rutledge Press. And what has been the process?
Been a little slower than we expected.
No.
But it is. And I just had to write to my editor this morning and say, well, we need a little more time. I got all last night. Unexpected from a friend of ours in the coalition, Gerardo Reyes Chavez. If Gerardo ever listens to this, well, Gerardo. but part of that conversation involved him saying, could we have a couple more weeks so that they can look? But of course, that's practice.
Mm-hmm.
We've been in conversation with them all along, but they're asking to take a look at things.
That's a picture. Is this the first scholarly work? A book published?
No, there's a small cottage industry.
Yeah.
And I recommend to this literature, there's really, really good things.
Mm-hmm.
There's a well-known book by a lady by the name of Susan Marquis called I Am Not a Tractor. Received a good bit of attention and tells the whole history of the coalition.
Mm-hmm.
There, like I said, many other academic articles.
Okay, so that's interesting. So maybe that's pushed the publication back a little bit.
Conversation with Gerardo. Yeah, that pushed it back.
Yeah, yeah. So, along with your great expertise in this field and rhetoric and public communication and that field, you are a faculty member. You are a teacher, and anybody that taught high school is definitely a teacher.
Yeah,
you did it quite a while. So, you've been at a large. The University of Miami is private.
Right.
So you've got a large private institution. You've been at a very large public institution. It is the biggest in Georgia, I'm pretty sure.
Yes.
Public. And it's huge, huge place. And you've been at an institution in the prairie.
Right.
And you've been here.
Right.
So so you've had a wide experience. And so I'd like your thoughts on maybe the state of higher ed. You know, you've had maybe a long view of things and
sure.
Where you see it going or not going.
Here's what I would say is I'm a first generation, or I was first generation college student. And when I went back to school at middle age, I was a non-traditional student.
Mm-hmm.
Southwest Minnesota State, I worked a great deal with a program called Solid Bridge, where we had students coming in a month ahead of time, highly diverse, many of them first generation. Spent time with them, us helping them transition into a university. And I loved working with those students because I got a sense of what the mission of public higher education is. To help these students transition the world, citizen, age, citizens.
Right.
Through that work, I became very interested in something called grading for equity. I know that word equity, of course, a hot buzzword. I don't think that's necessary. But what grading for equity says is that we need to clarify our standards so that we know what it is that we're asking students to achieve. And what the research is showing on grading for equity is that when we do this well, we can actually close achievement gaps in meaningful way, by which I mean not lowering our standard one bit, that we may clarify, basically. At the same time, if we do this well and use research-backed methods, we can find ways of helping students from diverse backgrounds, diverse racial backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, gender background, all to achieve high standard. In fact, you mentioned Georgia State, one mm-hmm. places. So I'm interested in those sorts of things. If I can digress just sure. this little bit, one of the problems we've had in education, this goes back, this covers all states, primary, secondary, university level. We've tended to draw our classrooms on points where Professor Tucker's it's tougher than Professor Berger's.
Right?
And we've looked at points somehow being here. And what we haven't done is we haven't done enough work to clarify what are standards. What does it mean? And problematize a certain, why do we assume that all students should get C's? I mean, that's sort of, we really know what an A or a B or a C is. That the real concern becomes, why aren't all our students getting A's?
Easy.
Right? Because an A or a B means exceeded. So I'm really interested in sorts of.
Right. And well, yes, and it's sort of like it goes back to what do we really want them to know achieve, understand after a certain length of time in a course.
Right.
You know, and I just feel like so much of it has been almost premised on ambiguity.
Yes.
That, you know, it's almost like a little game. The faculty is not going to let the students know totally. So they have to figure it out. And if they're good at solving mysteries, maybe they'll figure out what the teacher wants.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. And I think we've done a good deal of that.
Yes. Exactly. Almost as, and proud of it. It's, you know, I think the word rigor is, you know, that's always a word that we like to throw around, but we don't know what it means. You know, what does rigor right. mean? It's just, I'm hard. Okay. Does it mean that you require a lot of work? Does it mean that your concepts are hard? Does it mean that you're impossible to figure out? I mean, what is rigor?
Right. So, but we have, in doing this, we have to balance that off against academic freedom.
Right.
So that I walk Professor Tucker's classroom and say,
you're doing it wrong.
You're going to do exactly this.
Are you familiar with the teaching, learning and transparency, the TILT?
I know of it.
Yeah. To me, that's very tied into what you're saying, although it's very much focused on the individual assignment. Like if I want you to write a paper, you know, if I assign a paper, that I'm going to structure the assignment in such a way that it shows the value and how it fits into the whole scheme of learning in the class. It gives very specific requirements. It talks about, it has a rubric involved. It has, you know, examples involved, this kind of thing, which is, you know, I do it, and it's very helpful for the students, but it tends to be this whole problem that I've been discussing with colleagues about assessment, that it becomes very granular. You know, it's very much about this assignment, but you know, you can get lost with the tree instead of the forest. You know?
Yes.
It's, you don't want to lose those two perspectives. So yeah, these are discussions that I've been having with, since we've been having to do a lot of work on assessment here, and I won't get into that.
Well,
it's been a journey.
Some of the granular details of those discussions as well. But yeah, I've been very interested though in grading for equity.
Yeah, especially for online teaching, you know, but it affects everything as well. Yeah. And I started working in faculty in instructional development back in 2006. And I was, you know, did a lot of work in that. And one thing I did find though is that when you are wanting to make these changes, that a lot of faculty have been, especially have been around a while, we've seen so many trends and so many things, that the first thing you have to watch is not have any, this would be true of anybody, any working for any group, is that you're doing it wrong. You know, and too many of these things I've sat through have just been premised on, we've been doing it wrong. You're wrong. You don't know what you're doing.
Right.
You're not going to win any friends that way.
Yeah, I don't know if you're familiar with Parker Palmer.
Yeah.
Is one of my favorite authors. Well, I used to teach a secondary teaching methods course up in Minnesota. I would give students books.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I think he just has this really pragmatic, really art.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things that Parker Palmer says, we have to balance what are our standards and how can we set faculty free work with us?
Yeah. And trust the faculty too. Sometimes
right.
Like, I want to thank Rick Herder for coming to talk to me today and being recorded so that we could put it on this podcast. And I'm hoping to have Rick speak to our faculty institute at some point because of his expertise. So thank you for listening today. Goodbye.